o'clock. Driving. No purchase necessary.
The following is a live show streaming from two radio show producers / sports fans. Ray Atkinson and Josh Hall have one mission: to gain your attention. This is the Baltimore Sports Free-for-All.
Well, that was an interesting game for the Baltimore Ravens this past week.
Interesting how? Interesting in the fact that they've turned the ball over via the passing game, or interesting via bad decisions by the coaching staff?
A little bit of column A, a little bit of column B, and then there's a column C that a lot of people want to add in the mixture, and that is the referees on one call.
You know what? I'm looking down the docket of the topics that we're going to discuss on this week's show, and it all just seems so negative in a way that...
Especially when you factor in the Maryland Terrapins.
Well, don't we have some replay from some Maryland fans that were in attendance for that Maryland-Wisconsin blowout?
I believe we do.
Stop! He's already dead!
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of happy people, don't you think, Josh?
They were crying. There were some crying kids in that thing. It was depressing.
There's no crying in the Big Ten.
Nope, and there's no crying in baseball, where Buck Showalter was stiffed by Sporting News.
Again.
Yawn.
Yeah, again. Yeah, but seriously, who cares? He's Buck Showalter.
It's not the official award. And, of course, we'll talk about that. And I guess it just seems like the trend for Super Bowl teams that are having trouble the year after they win the Super Bowl is catching up, especially to the Seattle Seahawks.
Yeah, but here's the thing.
They did win. They did win in this week's matchup.
They actually did win, but Josh, they won against the Carolina Panthers. The Carolina Panthers are not good.
No, they're not good at all.
At all.
But the NFC South, of course, is not a good division, like we have stated all year round.
It is not a good division whatsoever when a team with four losses is the division leader.
Well, you know what is good and consistent and fun to listen to?
The Baltimore Sports Free-for-All.
Which you can find on
sfmsports.net.
And our Facebook page.
That would be the Baltimore Sports Free-for-All podcast.
And our Twitter page.
Be Sports Free, the number four all.
And my blog.
Monday Mornings with Josh.
Monday Sports Mornings with Josh. Which, of course, you will find on blogger.com, where I will be talking Orioles, Ravens, maybe a little Caps talk as well, and of course...
Wait, will you be talking or will you be blogging?
I'll be blogging. Thank you for that correction there, Mr.
Yeah,
Atkinson.
I mean, unless you actually voice text the whole blog, then
that
would be
pretty
talking.
Cool. That would be pretty cool, just to make it one soundbite and call me Ishmael. No,
but, I mean, you actually write out the blog with voice text.
No, but what was the name of those audiobooks? It would be like an audiobook, per se, on
Blogger. You going to put it on iTunes?
No, I'm not going to put it on iTunes.
Darn, that would give us a little more exposure.
You know, some people, they just would rather read text and not hear sound. Some people just like complete silence, I guess, in their morning. And also, on this week, on the week's edition of my new blog, Tyler Ward, once again, my young protege, will be making NFL Week 9 picks. So we'll see how that turns out. So let's just start off with the negative, like we're going to start off with most of the stories, all negative.
Yeah, we're going to be negative Nancy's today.
Yeah, yeah.
Considering we were wrong, weren't we?
We were wrong on so many levels.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's the thing about the Baltimore Sports Free-for-All is that we make predictions. We're human just like everybody else. We get things right. We also get things wrong. And then we say when we get things wrong, we'll talk about it.
Yeah, it's not so much of a mea culpa like we did with the Orioles and Royals ALCS predictions.
That series is going seven.
Yeah.
Yeah, how'd that work out?
Well, the World Series may go seven games. Giants are playing a little catch-up, so...
Yeah, and they also had something happen that has really not happened at all in this playoffs. They had a blowout win.
Yeah, well, the Royals finally had a blowout loss, so maybe the brash underdogs. You know what? I can't even put brash and underdogs in the same sentence because it doesn't go together.
No, it really doesn't.
It seems like a violation of Sports Code 101.
Yeah, it seems like you want to root for them as the underdogs, and when they're wearing t-shirts that call out their other team, and when they're actually calling out the other team by saying they got hard tagged or kneed in the face or whatever it is, it's like... I don't know. I'm kind of losing the darling underdog status. It's like the polish is wearing off on you a little bit right there.
It's kind of like you're wishing on every player like Eric Hosmer. I hope your car gets keyed before you get to your car.
That's a terrible thing, Josh.
What, getting your getting your car keyed up?
Yeah, I mean, come on. You know how much auto paint...
What, Go Giants?
You know how much auto paint costs nowadays?
Oh, Eric Hosmer can afford it.
I mean, I'm talking about in general. I mean, come on. I mean, if you get your car keyed, how much would it cost for you to get that fixed?
Getting my car fixed or my car key fixed?
No, not your car key.
Car keys, who breaks
a car key keying a car?
You would be shocked at how weak some keys can be, especially if you paid the wrong price for them.
Okay, well, how about this? And especially if it has a chip in it, that makes it even worse. But yeah, makes it much worse. Come on. How much would it cost to fix and touch up your car for a key?
Wouldn't the average paint job be around $2,000?
Yeah, it's not very cheap. So somebody keying your car is no laughing matter, Josh. You shouldn't joke about that, man.
That's like
lives are at stake here.
You know, for most people in this country, that's like a month and a half's pay after taxes right there.
Yeah, exactly. So now let's move on to the guys that have pay that will far exceed everybody else's. That's the Baltimore Ravens. They lose against the Cincinnati Bengals 27-24. Seemed like they were out of this game for pretty much the get-go. They only had like their first lead in the fourth quarter?
Yeah, they had their first lead in the fourth quarter, and they were just playing catch-up most of the game. And it seemed funny to me how this game was kind of reminiscent of the week one matchup at M&T Bank Stadium, where it was just bad coaching decisions, bad player personnel decisions, and turnovers once again. And we talked about this on our last episode, that Joe Flacco had to play mistake-free football in order to beat this Bengals defense. And given the fact that he threw two interceptions and only completed 50% of his passes, you could say that played a part in this game and the result. But there were other coaching decisions that played a huge part in this game that kind of, let's just say, bit the Ravens back in the rear later on.
Yeah, you're talking about and you're referring to in general, as in the first quarter when it was fourth and goal on the 1 yard line, they elected to go for it. And that's always ticky tacky for me. Sometimes I say go for it, other times I say just take the points, and it all depends on the situation right here. Now, why do you think it was a bad call?
Well, I think it was a bad call because, look, I understand it's a division rival. I understand, especially in Week 8, this game is just as important as it would have been if it was Week 16, Week 17. And for the Baltimore Ravens, I just feel like this is a situation where you haven't had a good track record in recent memory against the Cincinnati Bengals and their defense, especially at Paul Brown Stadium, where I've mentioned before on our last show, the Ravens were 4-1. In their last five games at Paul Brown Stadium. Well, now that record's 5-1, considering the fact that they just made bad decisions on the coaching staff and the play call. I understand that your running game was doing quite well up to that point, up to that first attempt at scoring. But sometimes your gut tells you one thing, but common sense would tell you another. Look, you got a kicker that's Pro Bowl solid. Just go get the 3 points.
Well, Pro Bowl solid, but any kicker can make a field goal from pretty much the 1 yard line.
Well, you should be able to.
And it's less than an extra point if you think about it.
Yeah, and I had somebody mention to me on my recent Facebook post regarding what cost the Ravens that game. He said, first of all, those points are not, that field goal is not automatic. I'm like, from half a yard?
From half a yard, that is an automatic field goal.
Are you serious? Okay, first of all, if a kicker misses that, even if it's a blocked field goal, you should be able to make that kick. If you don't make that kick, I'm sorry, you shouldn't be in the league.
The odds are better that...
It's not Grammatica kicking, okay?
The odds of you making that kick are, far greater than making that fourth down.
Yeah, much greater. And even though it seemed like a good play at the time because Flacco was running a hitch route, a fake that he was running with Taliaferro back there, and was thrown to Kamar Aiken. Kamar Aiken did have two defenders on him, but at the same time, that ball was kind of in his breadbasket to go and get it. And then, next thing you turn the ball over on downs and have to start all over again, especially against an offense that was red hot to start the game.
Yeah, so, I mean, but you got them backs against the wall and everything like that. They got to march 99-plus yards in order to get a touchdown, and odds are against that as well. And at the same time, you have to think about it that way, that there's still a lot of game left to play. But, yeah, I mean, in that instance, too early to be going for it on fourth and goal in that situation. Take the points. But another bad coaching decision that you probably think you and I might be a little bit on disagreement on this is the Ravens' last defensive stand.
Right.
They, or lack thereof defensive stand, because they allowed the Bengals to score in the red zone, is that they called two timeouts on when the Bengals were on the 1 yard line trying to march in the end zone. They eventually did on fourth down, and you see that they take the two timeouts. The Bengals still had three timeouts left. So even if the Bengals do not get that conversion and score a touchdown on fourth down, they still had three times to stop the clock, and they would have the Ravens pinned up against the wall late in the game, and it would be up to them to make a play. And you saw how explain to me now why you think that calling two timeouts in a situation is not the right call to make by John Harbaugh.
All right, well, let's look at it this way, Ray. The Ravens were up, I believe, 24-20 at the time against the Bengals, and their defense was making a goal line stand and was doing good for a little bit, was holding the running backs, you know, back behind the line of scrimmage, and they were doing a solid job. Now, me having watched football for a long time, and I know that I'm in no place to criticize NFL head coaches and what they decide, what timeouts to...
Oh, sure you are, Josh. You're a guy with a microphone on the internet. That you have a place to criticize a head coach.
Well,
trust me.
At least I have a face. At least I have a real name, and at least people know who is telling this opinion, rather much so than a guy named Jokester 996 that has a fake avatar that nobody will find the real identity of. But no, getting back to this decision that Harbaugh and the coaching staff made late in the fourth quarter, I believe that if you're a team that is winning, you shouldn't act like a team that's in panic mode. And I believe that when you waste two of your timeouts, where I think the Ravens weren't really in a position to waste those timeouts, if anything, you want the clock to kind of tick down. You want to put the Bengals in panic mode, because say the Bengals decide to just kick a field goal on fourth instead of go for it, and they kick the field goal, and the Ravens get the ball back. Bengals still had three timeouts. They stop the Ravens on all three timeouts on offense. They get the ball back with about, I don't know, 30, 25 seconds left. And then it requires a huge play, and we've seen it in the game. Mohamed Sanu starting at wide receiver. Wow. A.J. Green was out in this game. The star wide receiver, three-time Pro Bowler for the Cincinnati Bengals, Mohamed Sanu, tore up the Baltimore Ravens.
Especially, he was the hero in week one for the Cincinnati Bengals when he caught that deflection off of himself and managed to run it in that way.
And you're talking about Green on that play,
yeah,
right?
I'm talking about A.J. Green, yeah, but Mohamed Sanu embraces his inner A.J. Green, and then you had it to where Steve Smith would have answered right back, but... You want to talk about that stand that the Ravens had with under 2 minutes. It was first and goal. It was first and six at the two-minute warning. And then Hill, let me see here. It was they were in the shotgun formation. And Hill,
yeah, shotgun formation.
Yeah, it was a run for like 2 yards.
Right.
And then they
were stuffed on the next two plays.
They were stuffed on the next two plays. The first play, they were stuffed. And then here comes it was a minute and 27 when they snapped second and four. So they ran a little bit of time off the clock there because that's what they wanted to do. If they wanted to score, they wanted to knock as much time off of that clock as possible so the Ravens would have no chance to answer back. So therefore, they run about, like, what was it, 33 seconds off the clock,
right,
after first down.
Right.
So they were obviously trying to milk the clock and say, we're going for it because they're in four down territory. Field goal is not an option. They know that a field goal is not going to help them at all in this situation. So the Ravens call a timeout on the second down, and then they also call a timeout on third down. That leaves the Bengals one more opportunity to score, and lo and behold, they did score.
I mean, I understand that you use your timeouts to take time to recollect your thoughts and get your mind right for the next play coming up or the next play formation coming up, which I understand sometimes defenses need that to kind of recoup. But given the fact that this game, the momentum could change in any way whatsoever. Had the Ravens not taken those two timeouts, we don't know what would have happened. We don't know if the Bengals would have went for it on fourth still. We don't know if they would have kicked a field goal, which would have decreased their margin by 1 point. So they would have gotten the ball back and tried a game-winning field goal.
Well, let's put it this way, Josh.
But I'm just saying, though, teams with leads don't take timeouts because then you look like the team in desperation.
Yeah, but sometimes you do and sometimes you don't. There's situations you go with right here. And what I want to talk about here, Josh, is that when the Ravens allow the Bengals to score, there was a minute and 1 second left on the clock, and all you needed was a field goal to tie the game and send it into overtime. Okay, maybe I should question it like this. Maybe the Ravens should have allowed the Bengals to score in that situation and keep those two timeouts. That way they can march down the field and go with
ifs and buts were candy and nuts, every day would be Christmas.
Yeah, yeah, ultimately it came down to what the defense had to do, and they had to stuff them on the goal line at 4th and 1 because they had the Bengals at 4th and 1 in 4-down territory. It was 1st and 6, 1st and goal, and they couldn't do it. And prior to that, it was a Mohamed Sanu 52-yard pass from A.J. Green. It was that was what ultimately cost the Ravens right there at the end of the game right there. That last defensive stand this defense that looked so good in the second half, forcing two different turnovers and one freaky-looking turnover where they got Mohamed Sanu. Mohamed Sanu made it look like an outstanding catch, and all of a sudden it got stripped, and it went right up in the air right into a Raven defender, and that allowed the Ravens to do what they do best in the second half. And unfortunately, you know, they didn't play clutch like they were for pretty much the entire second half. That defense it seemed like it kind of ran out of gas there at the end. And, yeah, they got burned by Mohamed Sanu for that 52-yard pass. I think that was the play, really, that decided the game. But then you go into the next drive where, yeah, the Ravens had 57 seconds left on the clock. They have to march at least a good, I'd say, 50, 60 yards in order to get into field goal range, right?
At least 55 yards.
To get into field goal range, which, yeah, wouldn't be a gimme, but Justin Tucker just boomed one earlier.
He had two field goals over 50 yards in the Week 8 matchup.
Yeah, it was a 53-yard field goal that he just absolutely clobbered. It would have been good from 70 yards.
Yeah, it had air.
I looked at that kick, and I was like, oh, my gosh, this Justin Tucker kid is amazing. Billy Kundiff who?
Yeah.
Everyone has instantly forgotten about Billy Cundiff because of Justin Tucker. So, 57 seconds left. This was your drive. Joe Flacco, incomplete. Third down. This was the play.
This was the play that
everyone will
changed
be talking
the momentum
about.
In the Bengals' favor.
Everybody will be talking about this, and that is the fact that Joe Flacco threw an 80-yard pass, and 60 of it, by the way, was in the air. Mm-hmm. That was just a complete rocket that he threw to Steve Smith. It was amazing, and it looked like he almost threw it off his back foot. It was so good, but it just the way he threw it, it was amazing. Steve Smith catches it, looks like he puts his hands a little bit there, he puts his hands on the defender, but it was Iloka.
I'm trying to look up the defender's name here.
Yeah, it was Iloka.
Yeah, George Iloka. Yeah, and this is what Iloka said post game. He said, quote, "That was pass interference 2 years ago. It was pass interference last year. It's pass interference this year, and it will be pass interference for the next 2 years. I knew it right away," end quote. Can we at least mention this? Because I don't ever want to accuse of NFL players flopping.
Oh, no, I'm not accusing. I'm saying he flopped.
Yeah. I mean, this isn't soccer. This isn't FIFA, World Cup, or anything where flops get you, you know, positive yardage and put you in better positions to try for a goal. No. Iloka, I think he knew exactly what he was doing on that play.
And, of course he did.
And on camera, it looked like a defensive back and a wide receiver going for, you know, fighting over.
It looked like equal contact.
Equal contact. And what Steve Smith did was he went in front of the ball and Iloka fell. And you know, it's amazing that this is how much prominence that George Iloka has. We can't even pronounce his name right. I mean, it's funny because maybe that was his spot. That was his role in the Bengals secondary, was to be the fall guy, no pun intended, to change the momentum in favor of the Bengals defense. So now what happens? The Ravens try to go for it on 3rd and long, incomplete.
Incomplete.
Fourth and long.
Fourth and long. Flacco gives it to Taliaferro for 13 yards, but just not enough because that pass interference play lost you 10 yards. And just going back to that, Iloka flop that he did. And it was a flop, Josh. There ain't no doubt about that. I'm not accusing him. I'm saying it is a flop. So, therefore, I mean, I'm looking at this and I'm saying to myself, man, that's a very Manu Ginobili-esque right there. He didn't look like he got shot with an AK-47 like some of these players do, where they just completely over-exaggerate. I'm like a referee. I'm like, I throw a flag on him for unsportsmanlike conduct. I'm like, really, dude? But at the same time, one play, you can't let the referees decide the game for you. Clutch teams do not do that.
Like Very I said, true. I your agree chance, with you 100%.
Your chance to put that game away was on the drive prior when you had the Bengals down there, and they were the ones who had to ultimately, you know, score a touchdown. A field goal was not an option for them. They had all three timeouts left. You could have easily stopped him right there, and lo and behold, you give up a 52-yard pass to Mohamed Sanu. Then you had four chances to stuff him on the goal line. You stuffed him three times, and then all of a sudden on the fourth time, you just couldn't do it. Andy Dalton runs up the middle for 1 yard, and it looked like that Ravens defense that was dominating right there just ran out of gas on that drive. That was your chance to win that game right there. Not even mentioning Joe Flacco's two turnovers, not even mentioning...
And 50% completion.
And 50% completion, which used to be like, you know, the benchmark for a quarterback. Is
a lot of deep balls that were overthrown.
If you were over 50%, or you were at or above 50% back in the day for quarterbacks, that was considered a good thing. Now it's like 65, 70% that considers you good. 50%, yeah, that's definitely a... That's the mediocre Joe that we see, you know, sometimes coming up through the ranks.
When things don't go the Ravens' way.
Yeah, and you saw how Justin Forsett had 4 yards per carry.
Yeah, 4 yards per carry off 17 carries, had 68 yards total, and he had three catches for 17 yards.
And Taliaferro did just as good.
Two touchdowns and two catches for 42 yards.
You would think that
once
would
again
be...
Once again, the running backs in dire situations were underutilized.
Yeah, but you think that with those numbers that the Ravens would be doing good, but lo and behold, they weren't, because Joe Flacco was trying to gunsling it way too much and forcing passes that just weren't there. And then you had that one freak interception where Torrey Smith stopped on a play because he got hit.
Concussion, yeah, but yeah, came back on the field, though.
Concussion. I think he also got poked in the eye, Josh.
Yeah, it was poked in the eye, but of course.
That hurts.
NFL protocol, you do have to take a concussion test and go on to the sidelines for a little bit to kind of recollect your thoughts. And, well, thankfully, Torrey Smith doesn't have any concussion issues. However, of course, the Ravens are going to keep an eye on him. No pun intended, of course, with the eye poke. But they're going to keep an eye on him all week leading up to the Week 9 matchup at the Pittsburgh Steelers. But looking at the Ravens receiving in this game, of course, you had Owen Daniels was out of this game. Of course, he had a knee procedure. So now it's going to be Crockett Gilmore lining up at tight end for possibly the next few weeks. And you had Michael Campanaro, who... in my opinion, had a good showing with the time that he was given, three catches for 40 yards, and including a nice diving grab that he made in the first quarter, which I look back on that replay and I say, when receivers go out and lay out for catches like that, they're going to see a lot more playing time, and I think this won't be the last time we hear Campanaro's name.
No, I would agree with that as well, considering that he at least performed well enough to give him a second look in games to come. But let's talk about the Iloka flop a little bit here, because we got to talk about this as the fact that, yeah, this play was one of those deciding plays, everything like that, but it wasn't the reason why the Ravens lost here.
Many benefactors that were leading up to that.
Yeah, but I am looking at college football, and I am looking at the professional football in the NFL, and flopping has definitely come to professional and college football, as it has in the NBA, as it has in soccer, and it almost makes the NBA unwatchable with all the fouls that are judgment calls. Pass interference is exactly that. It's a judgment call. And therefore can't really be challenged, because then it would be the referee challenging his own judgment. He would overrule his own judgment. I don't know if he would be cool with that. You would get maybe a second guy coming in, like a third party, what's the Fox, Mike Pereira. You'd get like Mike Pereira looking at it and be like, yeah, that's...
And Mike Carey from CBS, of course.
Yeah, that's not pass interference. But you look at Mike Pereira and Mike Carey, they also have two different opinions usually when something happens. Like,
of course.
If you look on the Twitter feed of Mike Pereira and what Mike Carey is saying or what each other, they usually contradict one another. It is a judgment call.
Exactly.
And you look at that way, the pass interference that it had, it was iffy here and there. It could have went either way. It wasn't obvious in one direction or the other, but I will say that Iloka flopped, and I think maybe the NFL needs to start addressing that a little bit, that making that a penalty, saying that, okay, maybe he did commit a personal foul by pushing you at the end of the play, but you're flopping, dude. You're trying to obstruct justice. It's like an obstruction of justice charge or something like that. You're not doing the game any favors by doing that. And maybe instead of having offsetting penalties, just say, okay, you get the penalty and do it that way. But this was not the play that decided the game. No, the referees didn't have a fix in against the Baltimore Ravens.
I gotta talk about that as well.
Because I'm gonna talk about this right here and there. Steve Smith was the benefactor of a referee call in week one. Do you not remember when he caught that touchdown pass and blatant face mask on Pac-Man Jones, grabbing him by the face
mask, which was on camera,
and wrestling him down to the ground on his way to a touchdown? But nobody's going to mention that. That's none of my business.
Well, no, you did. However, on our show following that game, you did mention that it was a nice roughhouse old school play that just wasn't called for a penalty. That was a defensive back and a receiver fighting over a football.
Well, not fighting over a football. Steve Smith had already caught that.
Oh, yeah, but of course you had a defender trying to go after the guy, and Steve Smith wanted no part of it. He just literally roughhoused Adam Pac-Man Jones.
Boy, what are you doing? Get out of my way.
Yeah, he just roughhoused Adam Pac-Man Jones. But looking at the Iloka play and how, of course, post-game, everybody will say, oh, there's a conspiracy with the referees. They, you know, that was a homer call, yada, yada, yada. It's a judgment call. Believe me, there are going to be calls made in the Ravens' favor. There may be calls made in the Ravens' favor on Sunday Night Football against the Pittsburgh Steelers, especially if the game is tied and the Ravens have the ball with a minute left and they're driving down the field. That could change the game.
Clutch teams do not allow the refs to decide the game.
Exactly.
Period.
Mistakes made on the coaching staff, mistakes made on offensive personnel, that cost the Ravens their Week 8 matchup against the Cincinnati Bengals, resulting in the Bengals' first sweep against the Baltimore Ravens since 2009. And now the Ravens are 1-5 in their last six meetings against the Cincinnati Bengals at Paul Brown Stadium. But let's move on to Week 9, which now...
Steeler Week.
And had the Ravens won their Week 8 matchup against the Bengals, me and Ray would have agreed that it would have been a must-win game for the Pittsburgh Steelers. Well, considering the fact that you have the Cincinnati Bengals leading 4-2-1. Yeah, I know, folks, it sounds crazy with math and everything, but yes, the Cincinnati Bengals, as of this podcast, are leading the AFC North with a record of 4-2-1. The Ravens are second at 5-3, and the Steelers are in third, mainly because the Ravens won in Week 2. And, of course, you have the head-to-head matchups in your own division in the AFC North.
These always make my head hurt, by the way.
They always do, but they do play a part in your postseason positioning. And not to mention, you have the Cleveland Browns who are, dare I say it, 4-3 coming off of the bye week and just basically, well, they've had a bye week already, but now no bye weeks ahead for them for the rest of the year. We're talking about a very competitive division, and the Ravens, I hate to say this is a must-win game for the Ravens against the Steelers, but it's a must-win game for the Baltimore Ravens in Week 9 on Sunday Night Football.
I'm not a really big fan of the whole title of must win.
I think it's must win.
Well, that's because that's what you have to do when you come out every week. That is your job, is to win. Every week is a must win for the for a professional football team.
Okay, so
it's not like baseball where you can have like a few throwaway games in a 162-game season. But no, when you have 16 games, every game is a must win. And if you don't win those, it hurts your chances to get into the playoffs.
All right, so let me rephrase this. The Ravens are 5-3, correct?
That they are.
All right, and they've already played 8 weeks into the NFL season, correct?
Yes.
All right, so what are they projected to go for the remainder of the year? 5-3,
so that makes them 10-6.
Yeah, and you would think that that's good enough to make the AFC playoffs, right?
Maybe,
yeah. And that's how competitive the division...
Not exactly a key, you know, proven
definitely
point.
Definitely a winning season. Definitely an improvement from 2013. But this is a much more competitive division than the Ravens had hoped for, especially after last week where the Ravens were 5-2 and they were just on cloud nine, getting ready to pounce on a Bengals team that's that was 0-2-1 in their previous three games. But looking at the Week 9 matchup against the Steelers came off of a butt-whooping victory over the Indianapolis Colts, a Colts team leading up to the Week 8 matchup that was one of the best in the league up at that point.
Yeah, and Ben Roethlisberger put up 500-plus on them.
522 yards, 6 touchdowns, both franchise records for the Pittsburgh Steelers right there. Yeah, if you had Ben Roethlisberger on your fantasy team, you better have won that matchup.
I knew somebody who had Ben Roethlisberger on the bench and started Tom Brady.
Yeah, that is that.
It's like, wow.
Well, you still
did you have the best of both worlds there, because Tom Brady had 5 touchdowns this week.
Yeah, you
he made Brandon LaFell look like Randy Moss,
and he made Rob Gronkowski look like Shannon Sharp, which of course is pretty easy for Rob Gronkowski, but because he's a heck of a talent, but had some injury-prone years, but has proven to be a hot commodity for the Patriots and their 2014 playoff run, or run to the playoffs, I guess, if I could correct myself there on that. But this was the scary stat right here for Roethlisberger in his 51-34 win over the Colts in Week 8. 40 for 49. Completion.
80%.
At least more than 80%.
Yeah.
That's scary.
That is very scary, considering the fact that what Andy Dalton did to the Ravens secondary late, what is Ben Roethlisberger going to do next week in prime time?
Yeah, and I guess if there is any positive note that you can carry with you into this game, it's that the Steelers' defense allowed 448 yards and 4 touchdowns to the Colts, the visiting Colts.
Yeah, gunslinging.
Yeah. So, looking at this Ravens team, I guess it's safe to say after the last 6 meetings that the Cincinnati Bengals have Joe Flacco's number. Not only do they have his number, they have his address, they have his they have his bank account codes, they have all
they have his social security number.
Yeah, yeah.
They've doxed him.
It's pretty safe to say that Joe Flacco wants to forget about Cincinnati for the rest of 2014. But against the Steelers, though, Joe Flacco has had some success.
That he has, and it's going to be really tough to call this game, Josh.
Yeah, because I still believe it's a must-win game for the Baltimore Ravens. Had the Ravens won against the Bengals, of course, I think it would have been the other way around for the Steelers. But the Steelers are coming off of a huge win over the Indianapolis Colts. They're going to be riding a high into Sunday Night Football. I do think that they're going to contain Ben Roethlisberger a little bit, but I think Roethlisberger and company, they're still going to put up the offensive yards because, hey, that's the Steelers' offensive plan. That's what they have thrived upon all year. Roethlisberger putting up big yards, Le'Veon Bell being a threat in both the backfield and as a receiver. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this Ravens defense reacts, especially given the fact that they were just home run hitters against a Bengals team, but those home runs weren't enough.
Yeah, Antonio Brown, 10 receptions for 133 yards. He caught 2 of Roethlisberger's 6 touchdowns.
Guy to watch out for.
Yeah, and Heath Miller, all of a sudden, 7 receptions, 112 yards, 1 touchdown.
Yep, Heath Miller, great career numbers against the Baltimore Ravens lifetime. And seems to have found new life, I guess you could say. How old is he now? 32, 33 years old? I think him and Roethlisberger are around the same age.
Yeah, yeah. Right? Heath Miller is 32 years old, as is Roethlisberger. Came in the league almost at the same time. Martavis Bryant, 22-year-old rookie, also had a big game on the receiving end of Roethlisberger's passes. 5 receptions for 83 yards, 2 touchdowns. And all of a sudden, now you got to look at the way he was spreading the ball around. That is bad news for a Ravens secondary right now.
Yeah, so looking at this game, knowing that the Steelers are capable of putting up huge yardage against anybody, it seems, this year, looking at the fact that Joe Flacco does have a form of success against the Steelers in his lifetime, how do you see this game panning out in Week 9, and who do you have winning?
Well, the last time that I predicted a gun-slinging fest, that was the Ravens and Falcons game. That turned out not to be true. So I'm going to try again here. I'm going to think that it's going to be once again a, you know what? No, because both teams, the Steelers had a big time performance on offense. I don't think that they can do that again 2 weeks in a row.
So you're saying they're going to be gassed coming into Sunday Night Football?
I'm going to say that lightning will not strike twice there.
We've seen strange things happen in the National Football League. We've seen the Jacksonville Jaguars get their first win of the year.
I mean, come on. We saw a Browns-Raiders game that was 9-6 for most of the game. That's a big yawn fest. But I think that this is going to be...
Raiders still didn't get a win today.
Well, Pittsburgh's defense, not exactly what it used to be. I mean, they're bringing James Harrison out of retirement. That should say enough right there. But my heart wants to tell me that it's going to be a defensive matchup. My brain is telling me that it's going to be, once again, an offensive-type matchup. Oof. Let's go middle of the road here and say 27-24.
I thought you were going to say 27-27 tie.
Yeah. Why not predict a tie?
You know what? I'm going to do it.
You're going to predict a tie?
17-17, it's going to be a tie.
You're 17-17, it's going to be a tie.
Oh, wait, hold on. No, actually, I'm going to take that back, because when was the last time we saw an overtime game on Sunday Night Football or Monday Night Football? Never.
Yeah.
It has been a long time. I don't think the networks would allow it. So I'm going to retract that statement. I see the Ravens winning this game 16-13. I think Justin Tucker plays a huge part. I think the Ravens take their points when they need them. They don't go for it on fourth. I think Harbaugh will learn from his mistakes. And I think Flacco will have a mistake-free game. So that is my prediction right
now. I was going to say 27-24 and just the same score as what was on Sunday. But who is going to be the one that has the 27, the one that has the 24? Steelers.
Really? So you're going to play, you're going to be Razor Ramon. You're going to be the bad guy, right?
I'll be the bad guy. I'll be the heel on this one and say the Steelers are going to win next week. It's going to tie the season series at 1-1. It's going to make the AFC North even more complicated.
Dang, Ray, you were on a homer roll for a little bit with the Ravens. I think this is the first week you picked against them. Am I correct?
Let me see. Did I pick against them again with the Falcons though?
No. You had there was the Bengals, then it was the Steelers, and then you had the Browns. You may have picked the Browns in that game, I think.
I think I did because I thought it was a dangerous trap game, so to speak. And I thought this wasn't your older brother's Cleveland Browns. Right. I thought they were going to win that game.
Yeah.
Ah, so much for that. But, yeah, I'm going to go with the Steelers on this one.
27-24.
Yeah, just based solely on the fact that, I mean, the Lightning is not going to strike twice with that offense. Roethlisberger is not going to put up 500 yards 2 weeks in a row.
For the sake of hilarity, I hope for a tie, but in reality, I think it's going to be 16-13. It'll be low scoring. It'll be kind of boring.
But your initial prediction was 17-17 tie.
Yeah, but
that would have been great if Donovan McNabb was the quarterback for one of these teams.
Yeah, but I don't think
he didn't know the game ended in a tie.
Yeah, but I don't think NBC is going to let that happen. Conspiracy. But
no.
No.
There is no conspiracy. Yeah, just like Goodell turned off the lights at Superdome
47. Or maybe a conspiracy by Seattle fans that the national media is tearing their team apart. Teammate by teammate.
Percy Harvin is gone. Marshawn Lynch may be gone, considering the fact that the team doesn't want to re-sign him for next year, which, I mean, Marshawn Lynch is 28 years old.
Right. And he found new life with the Seattle Seahawks. And the reason we had this as our discussion, folks, is because normally when Super Bowl teams come off of a huge year, well, actually, when teams come off of a Super Bowl year, if I were to rephrase that, you would think that the moods for the morale for all 53 men on the roster would be on the up and up. Well, given how mediocre the Seattle Seahawks offense and defense have been this year, especially their defense. And yeah, look, I don't care if they had a nice stellar week eight win over the Panthers. It's still the Panthers. The Panthers are a struggling football team, just like the Seattle Seahawks. But isn't it funny how we see teams, and I'll go back to 2004 here. 2004-05 season, of course, that was the year Terrell Owens was supposed to be traded to Baltimore until he found out Kyle Bowler was his quarterback, so he went to...
Can you blame him on that now, in hindsight?
I can't blame him on that. Much like I can't blame John Elway for not wanting to go to the Colts since Bob Irsay was the owner, and since he probably knew that the team was going to get moved eventually. But looking at that season, Terrell Owens was a godsend for Donovan McNabb. He was the go-to guy. He made you proud to be a Philadelphia Eagles fan in that season.
For one season.
Now, flash forward, you go to the Super Bowl. Fredex Mitchell, I can't believe he made a name off of that, helped Donovan McNabb along the way. Think about it. the Eagles still won the NFC Championship without Terrell Owens in their receiving core throughout that the NFC playoff series. You go to the Super Bowl, you're facing the Patriots, Terrell Owens gets back into the game. The Eagles lose decisively to the Patriots, but to Terrell Owens' credit, he played the game injured, and he actually had a solid game. And you're thinking to yourself, okay, this Philadelphia Eagles team, they have found new life with Terrell Owens and Donovan McNabb, and they may have solid years for years to come.
Nope.
What happened in 2005? Well, the Eagles were mediocre. Andy Reid, the then head coach of the Philadelphia Eagles, told Terrell Owens to go home. Next thing you know, we see Terrell Owens shirtless in his driveway doing sit-ups, lifting dumbbells, and saying no comment after every reporter question.
It's surprising that Andy Reid actually survived that tenure right there and actually came, I think it was, 2012 was when he finally got let go from the Eagles?
And then went to the Chiefs in 2013, yeah.
And kind of turned them around a little bit there.
Oh, absolutely.
But yeah, now we're going to flash forward to the Seattle Seahawks, who won Super Bowl 48, and it seemed like they won it in convincing fashion, and then week one comes.
What a convincing fashion.
Yeah.
It was very convincing.
Yeah, and so week one comes around, and they blow out the Packers, and you're saying to yourself, whoa, they might not be the team that has a Super Bowl hangover. They may repeat. And all lo and behold, a couple weeks of mediocrity later, Percy Harvin is gone. Apparently, Russell Wilson is not black enough. And now you got reports of Marshawn Lynch not talking to Pete Carroll, not communicating. After the game on Sunday, Marshawn Lynch was asked, are you talking? Yeah, I'm talking. See ya. And just walked out of the press conference. And now TMZ, lo and behold, TMZ once again here, releases a nice little clip of Marshawn Lynch swinging his bag at the paparazzi, missing completely, knocking his headphones off of his head, along with his hat, and one of the more funnier things I've seen. And that sort of sums up Marshawn Lynch's status right now with the Seattle Seahawks. Granted, he's 28 years old as a running back. This is a common thing where this says the team doesn't want, they don't want to really play ball with you, so to speak, with the contract figure that you want. Marshawn Lynch has done many great things for the Seattle Seahawks. We'll never forget that run that he had against the New Orleans Saints where he broke like 6-7 tackles on one play and really, really gave new meaning to the phrase beast mode.
Just trucked over to safeties.
Yeah, so with everything that is going on right now, you see the reports that the Seahawks are definitely fed up with Marshawn Lynch. They don't want to deal with him anymore. Percy Harvin. There is a group of people in the locker room that are either pro or anti Russell Wilson. And you're thinking to yourself, how do you lose a locker room the year after you win the Super Bowl?
You know, I don't want to pin it all on Pete Carroll. Of course, Pete Carroll is the same guy who left the UFC amid allegations of NCAA violations. And six months later, after taking the Seahawks job, sent a video out to USC fans telling them to keep their heads high. So I wouldn't have put it past Pete Carroll to kind of be the pink elephant in the room to kind of divide the locker room. I wouldn't have put it past him at all. But in the same sense, though, who is the leader of the Seahawks?
You wanted to say...
Let's just say on offense. Who's the leader of the Seahawks on offense?
You got to give it to Russell Wilson.
Who is the face of their offense?
Russell Wilson.
So who should be the main voice of the team? Who should be the voice of reason?
Russell Wilson.
There you go. There you go indeed. And it puzzles me how a guy like Percy Harvin, who had so much promise out of his rookie year and going into the Super Bowl season, how he did not want to be a part of that culture, how he did not want to be a part of that. And I really hope he enjoys life with the New York Jets, because that is pure media hell right there, especially right now. You don't want to be a Jets fan right now. They just got rid of Geno Smith, Michael Vick now. They pretty much have admitted that the season's over, that Rex Ryan probably won't be back next season. You have all these things going on with the Jets, and, you know, hey, Percy Harvin, you're a very talented guy, but at the same sense, you're going to look back on this decision and say, you know what, maybe I should have been a cooler head in this whole thing. And I think Marshawn Lynch probably is going to have the same regret, especially if things don't turn around for the Seahawks this season and if things don't turn around for Lynch this season.
Yeah, and then you have it on defense. Where is this Legion of Boom at that we've been hearing so much about and that was so good last year all of a sudden is nowhere to be found? The leader on defense is definitely Richard Sherman, and I'm interested to see his comments about this whole Seahawks locker room debacle, because you think that he would also be kind of a voice of reason to step up and say, hey, because Richard Sherman, I mean, you can say what you want about Russell Wilson. Richard Sherman is the face of that franchise. And when he's silent, he's getting challenged by everybody under the golden sun. Phillip Rivers challenged him and won. And it seemed like, you know, that Legion of Boom is showing vulnerability. And you see that this locker room situation is just not the best for the Seattle Seahawks. And when you've got things seeping through the cracks right there in your locker room, it shows that you really don't have that good of a locker room, so to speak. And I think Richard Sherman should also be a voice that steps up and speaks and says, hey, this is BS, guys. We're the Super Bowl champions. Right. Why are we fighting each other?
Yeah, and you look back at the 2013 season with the Ravens. They were coming off of a Super Bowl victory. Everyone's morale was high, even with the departures of guys like Donnell Ellerbe, Paul Kruger, and Anquan Boldin, who played a pivotal role in the Ravens offense during that postseason. You had Ray Rice underperforming. You had Joe Flacco underperforming. And Joe Flacco was the face of that Ravens team at that time because he was the $120 million guy. He was on the McDonald's commercials. He was a face just like Richard Sherman now is a face on most commercials you see on television. And dare I say it, he is the 2013 Joe Flacco right now on defense, because every time I see Richard Sherman play, doesn't look like a Pro Bowler to me, Ray.
No, and not right now. And I guess that's what happens when you make yourself the lightning rod, when you make yourself the magnet, you put a target on your back and people put you under the microscope and you have to be able to live up to that hype. And if not, then it's like, here we go. It's like the Terrell Owens. The guy was an outspoken guy, completely a complete lightning rod for the media. And then when it came his time to underperform, people were, you know, really quick to criticize him. One person that you don't hear that about is Larry Fitzgerald. Larry Fitzgerald is completely silent.
Consummate professional.
Constant professional, consistent, by the way. And guy put up some serious numbers this week.
Calvin Johnson's the same way, too, for the Lions as well.
Yeah, it's just that when he has a bad game, it's not noticed as much because he doesn't talk about everything that often. But you see Larry Fitzgerald have a good game and a bad game. Larry Fitzgerald has underperformed as a fantasy football player this year, has underperformed a little bit in terms of receiving, but you don't hear about it because nobody wants to cover that, because Larry Fitzgerald is silent on the issue and remains a constant professional. When you make yourself out there, when you put yourself out there as a player, you put a target on your back, people will put you under the microscope. When you're not performing well, it shows, and it may or may not become a distraction depending on, you know, what your mental state of mind is right now. And with all these reports coming out about the Seattle Seahawks locker room, their mental state of mind is not very solid right now. And they beat the Panthers 13-9, Josh. This is the same team that tied the Cincinnati Bengals. This is the same team that
was crushed by the Ravens.
That was absolutely crushed Steve by Smith. The Ravens. And Cam Newton, has he been very disappointing this year or what?
He's a good quarterback having a mediocre season, much like the Seattle Seahawks all around are a good squad but having a mediocre season. And, of course, you know, leading up to the postseason run by most NFL teams, we'll definitely keep an eye on the Seahawks, because if you're a defending Super Bowl champion, you have a huge target on your back. And right now, by most of the NFL and by most of the media, that target has enlarged for the Seattle Seahawks.
And especially with all the reports now, people smell blood in the water. And right now, what did we say last year, Josh, when the Ravens won the Super Bowl? We said, they're Super Bowl champions, people. Relax.
They're Super Bowl champions. They're coming off of an award-winning season. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's a defending Super Bowl champion story, and we've seen it happen many times beforehand, and it probably won't be the last time.
Yeah, it won't be the last time, Seattle Seahawks, so chill out in the locker room and just celebrate the fact that you won Super Bowl 48, and no one can take that away from you for at least another couple of months.
And what most people cannot take away is the fact that the Orioles had a solid 2014 season. Granted, it didn't end the way that most Orioles fans would have hoped. But it seems like whenever something happens in the off season, I guess you could say, once their season's done, it just seems like it's either a positive thing or a negative thing. Whether it's J.J. Hardy or Adam Jones winning Gold Glove Awards, or whether it's a certain Orioles player getting a contract. One thing that Orioles fans seem to harp on was the progression of Buck Showalter as a manager. Well, according to Sporting News, in 2014, Buck Showalter, despite the fact that Manny Machado was out for the first month of the season and then had season-ending knee surgery later on, and considering the fact that Matt Wieters from May on moving forward was out for the year, and considering the fact that Chris Davis underperformed and was suspended the final 25 games of the season, it just was not good enough. And Mike Scioscia of the Anaheim Angels, according to Sporting News, is your AL Manager of the Year. Ray, is this a big deal or a little deal?
At the end of the day, I mean, a Manager of the Year is an outstanding award to win. But nobody remembers Managers of the Year. Can you name the Manager of the Year for 2005?
You know what? I would say Tony La Russa probably would be up there for the Cardinals.
What about 2007?
Yeah, I probably couldn't name.
1994.
I know Johnny Oates won 1993 Manager of the Year, 92 Manager of the Year for the Orioles, but that's neither here or there. Looking at this award, and it's Sporting News, this award is voted on by 15 American League managers. It's not the official award, but it's still a prestigious award nonetheless.
Yeah.
And by the way, 14 of 15 managers, only 14 of 15 managers voted on who would win the award. Obviously, we don't know who the 15th manager is. It could have been Joe Maddon. And now Joe Maddon's history from the Tampa Bay Rays.
Yeah, that was kind of a shocker out of left field. All of a sudden, you see Joe Maddon's not exercising he's exercising his opt out clause, and you're thinking to yourself, "Whoa, this guy was one of the big keys in turning the Tampa Bay Rays from the Devil Rays. He turned that franchise around, and to see him go is kind of sad. I do hope the Rays can continue their success that they've had under Joe Maddon with somebody else, because I think that the Tampa Bay Rays being good in the AL East is good for baseball as well as the Baltimore Orioles, and you no longer hear about Red Sox and Yankees. The more we can suppress Red Sox and Yankees, the happier that I will be, because I've just been hearing about that ad nauseum growing up. I'm just tired of the Red Sox and Yankees. Mm-hmm. I want to see somebody else win the AL East. I want to see somebody else go into it and, you know, just see that the AL East just doesn't belong to the Yankees and the Red Sox. And here, you know, the pundits on ESPN say, oh, the Orioles only won the AL East because the Yankees and the Red Sox had down years. I'm like, so they still won? Doesn't really matter. You can't take that away from them. They had to play the teams to win, and they did. So you look at this Manager of the Year award, so to speak, for Buck Showalter.
Sporting News
Manager of the Year.
You got to clarify that. Yeah, it's not the official award.
Buck will tell you, and he'll come out, and it seems to be an honest answer. He says, well, we didn't win the big thing. Those things are just awards, little things that give yourself pats on the back, and I'm not really all that big into them. I'm not really caring about that. I care about the World Series win that we failed to get.
Yeah, and the official awards, though, the Gold Glove Awards, the Rawlings AL and NL Gold Glove Award winners will be announced on November the 4th. And, of course, you have J.J. Hardy nominated for shortstop. You have Adam Jones nominated for one of the outfield positions. And guess what? Nick Markakis nominated. So maybe this is finally the year where Markakis wins his coveted second Gold Glove Award, which he was snubbed a few times in my
opinion. Still boggles my mind how a guy with that kind of track record out in right field of throwing guys out at home plate has only won one Gold Glove in his 9-year career.
And I would like to think that on November 11th, when the AL and NL Manager of the Year awards are announced, that we
the official ones, by the way.
The official ones, the ones that matter, the ones that lead the Hall of Fame careers. If Buck Showalter wins that award, definitely have something to talk about. And if all three Orioles, we'll say maybe, yeah, they'll be all three, I think, will win the AL Gold Glove Awards. But if none of them win, if all three of them are snubbed and Buck Showalter is snubbed, we're going to have some pessimism and negativity on the next few episodes of the Baltimore Sports Free-for-All.
That we will. But who predicted that the Baltimore Orioles will win the AL East and go all the way to the AL Championship Series? I would say nobody did, considering all things considering. So, yeah, it wasn't what the Orioles expected. And seeing Buck Showalter, look, the guy had to deal with his star shortstop going down, his star third baseman going down, his star first baseman underperforming, and then eventually getting suspended for the rest of the year, and will have to sit out opening day, by the way. And then he has to lose his star catcher right at the beginning of the season, when it seemed like his star catcher was turning a corner and was actually becoming a decent hitter for the ball club. And you saw all of those things that happened, the bullpen management that he had, putting in a guy that never closed really in his life, and Zach Britton, in his first year full-time closing, and performed admirably at the job, helped out Dan Duquette getting a trade in for Andrew Miller, which was a key difference for the Baltimore Orioles going down the stretch and in the playoffs, because Andrew Miller was the shining light out of everybody in that bullpen, over Darren O'Day, over Zach Britton. And I just can't see how the fact that he doesn't win the official manager of the year, considering, you know, Mike Scioscia is a sexy name, but then again, so is Buck Showalter, because Buck Showalter has been a manager of the Yankees. He's been featured on Seinfeld. He's been on ESPN. I think he's going to win the official award. One would think, but if
you
he
would
doesn't,
think, you would think.
But if he doesn't, guess what, Josh? It's not the end of the world, because the Orioles still have a great manager in Buck Showalter. People are, you know, saying that he's better than Weaver right now, and I'm like, whoa, quite the statement to make.
That's a bold statement. And real quick recap on the week that was college football in week 9. You had Alabama at number 4, keeping their number 4 spot, winning 34-20 over the Tennessee Volunteers. Or is it the Tennessee Volunteers or the Vols? What are they called nowadays?
Oh, you can Vols. Go either or.
Yeah, and it's funny how Lane Kiffin was the main attraction in that game. I was just thinking to myself, geez, media, do you have nothing better to do than to stir the pot for a game that pretty much Alabama is going to, you know, scoop up and win? But the number 3 team in the country, Ole Miss, loses 7-10 against LSU. Number 24 LSU, so that definitely changes the top 3 spot. May move Alabama to number 3. And, of course, you have the, excuse me here, the number 1 Mississippi State winning 45-31 over Kentucky. Kentucky was giving them a fight for a little bit, but Mississippi State came out on top, ended up winning that game.
Side note, why is it that whenever I Google the Tennessee Volunteers, the first thing that pops up is a thong?
I do not know why.
Yeah, Hanky Panky University, Tennessee University of Tennessee Volunteers low rise thong, yeah, on sale for $25.
And you had Bruce Pearl, I think, maybe suggested that, which is why I don't think he's the head coach of Tennessee anymore with the men's basketball program. Looking at more scores that stood out to me, Texas Christian University 82-27 over Texas Tech. I mean, you didn't expect Texas Tech to win this game, but to get slaughtered like that, do we have some reaction from that game?
Stop! He's already dead.
I never get tired of that. You know what? Let's use it one more time. Let's go to the Big Ten, where the Terrapins were going on the road to face the Wisconsin Badgers, the number 1 rushing attack in the nation. You'd think Maryland would have shown up at least against the Badgers. Here's some recap from that game.
Stop! He's already dead.
That they were. Take the foot off the throat.
52-7, Ray. 52-7. You know how many total yards the Terrapins had?
I want to say
Take a guess.
I want to say under 150.
Nope. 175.
Ooh, I was close.
And they didn't get over 100 yards until the fourth quarter.
Yeah, I wanted to play the guess. It's right in front of me. I just wanted to play the guessing game and just make it interesting for you guys. But, yeah, quite the blowout for the Maryland Terrapins. I guess this is where the people on their high horse say, see?
They're going to
get killed in the Big Ten. They were getting killed in the ACC, too, by the way. Just now they're getting more money while they're getting killed.
Wisconsin running back Melvin Gordon averaged 5.5 yards per carry and got 3 touchdowns and 122 yards rushing.
Okay, Tennessee Volunteers, go away, because there's a freaking thong on my computer now. Go, go away.
I guess we just got to bring this up real quick. Do you see the Terrapins winning any more games with C.J. Brown as quarterback? Because in my personal opinion, and this may be the meanest thing I could ever say to a college football player, C.J. Brown is garbage.
Wow. Do you want to get...
C.J. Brown is garbage.
Do you want to get Mike Gundy on you?
Well, you mean Randy Edsall? You want Randy Edsall to go Mike Gundy on me for saying
No, I'm saying you want me to get Mike Gundy on you because he's like, dude, you're criticizing a kid.
Well, C.J. Brown's 23 years old. He'll be 24 next year. I mean, technically, by that age, you're in the pros nowadays. So if you can't take criticism, I mean, if he's 18, 19 years old, I get it. I'm not going to criticize someone that young. But when you're in the Big Ten and we ask of you to progress as a collegiate quarterback, especially in Division I-A, you would hope that you would progress, you know, naturally, that your completion percentage would go up. I don't take anything away from C.J. Brown. He's a very good athlete. He's 6'3", 218 pounds, runs really well. But in my personal opinion, he is not the guy to lead the Terrapins at quarterback. Unfortunately, Caleb Rowe would be that guy, but Caleb Rowe is now out for the year, so you have to put up with C.J. Brown and see what the Terps do from there.
Terrapins just have rotten luck with these quarterbacks. Caleb Rowe and C.J. Brown just... I mean, Caleb Rowe out for the season, injured again. It's like, shoo.
And I hate to be critical of a college football player because, yeah, like you said...
That was mean, Josh.
I know it's mean, but I feel it needs to be said. Who knows? Maybe the Terrapins need criticism. Maybe we need to care of the fact that they're in a, in my opinion, a better conference now, a conference that has a nice shining light nationally. And the fact that you, in order to compete in this conference, you have to have solid quarterback play.
All right, well, let's look at the Terps' remaining four games in the Big Ten. They've got Penn State, which...
Penn State will put up a fight.
Penn State may also be an ugly game. Michigan State, that will also
That's
be...
That's a loss. That's a loss.
That's definitely a loss. Michigan in the Big House?
That's going to be a... Unless Michigan can make a turnaround, I think that's a win for the Terrapins.
And Rutgers at Bird.
That's a win for the Terrapins. So they do get 7 wins on the season if things don't go their way at the Nittany Lions and against Michigan State.
7-5 in their inaugural year in the Big Ten. I'd say that's pretty good for the Maryland Terrapins if they can pull it off. But, yeah, so they could go bowling this year with C.J. Brown at quarterback. You just absolutely just took a... You know, it took a dumpster fire, too.
You know, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I know I'm harsh for saying that, but I felt it needed to be said.
All right, so...
I didn't mean to go Mark Madden on the guy, but...
Well, I want to talk about my memorable moment in college football, and speaking of the Big Ten and Penn State and Ohio State, that was quite an interesting game, but the biggest thing that I saw out of that game was there was a lot of white confetti on the field. I'm thinking, what is all of that that's on the field? It looks terrible because you got your HD cameras going. It just looks like the field just has a little bit of shiny, and it's adding static to the camera. But lo and behold, it was that type of string that people use in like pom-poms and stuff. But it mainly came from one guy dressed as a sheepdog.
A sheepdog?
Yeah, he looked like a sheepdog. He dressed up as a sheepdog for the Penn State-Ohio State game, and it just littered the field with that pom-pom string. Everybody else had little white pom-poms as well. So, yeah, it was coming from them, but the main offender was the sheepdog, and he was even called out on national television, like, ladies and gentlemen, the stuff that's on the field is thanks to this guy. And he wasn't thankfully, he wasn't ejected. I'm like, don't eject that guy just because he wore a sheepdog costume and it failed to hold together. Don't get rid of the guy for that, especially since you can't say it strictly came from him. Most of it came from him because everybody else had pom-poms as well, so it could come out of that. So that was quite a memorable moment for me in college football. I like to go with the more comedic moments in college football.
You know what is sort of serious and kind of comedic?
Our two-minute rants?
Our two-minute rants. And... Ray, if you would like to keep tabs on me, sir, I would like to go first.
Okay.
Okay. I have to start off this week's episode by saying that while the four-letter network, or as most would know it as ESPN, does have a form of biased opinions, so to speak, especially in college football, on their Saturday program, College Game Day, which is hosted, of course, by Chris Fowler, Kirk Herbstreit, and a bunch of other panelists on that show. Of course, I'm trying to speed up the segment here. Chris Fowler took the time during that program to go on the air and say how ESPN, the same station that has a sister station on television, the SEC Network, how Chris Fowler went on the air and said that there is no bias, there is no such thing as an SEC bias with ESPN. And, of course, you had Lee Corso, Desmond Howard, and Kirk Herbstreit agreeing with Chris Fowler and his opinion on this whole thing. Well, I gotta disagree with Mr. Fowler and the whole ESPN staff on confronting this allegations of SEC bias. Okay, what about the bias regarding the New York Yankees coverage, the Boston Red Sox coverage, the Los Angeles Lakers coverage, the Kobe Bryant coverage? If need be, the LeBron James love fest that has went on for the past 10, 12 years that ESPN just seems to cover all the time. Or how about whenever Jimmy Johnson is winning a race and he's close to the Sprint Cup. Granted, it's acceptable given the fact that Jimmy Johnson has had a solid career as a NASCAR driver, but still. You had Tiger Woods. You had a whole list of things. Ray, if I am missing anything at all from this, I apologize. Kentucky basketball. I am amazed at how ESPN has done this for so long, and now they're coming out with a thought on the SEC bias. Give me a break.
Yeah, it seemed like they're trying to look out for their own. I used to call the TO Yankees Network in the mid-2000s, by the way. Well, my rant is not going to be so much as a rant. It's going to be having the, you know, break a little bit of a sad news on Sunday that St. Louis Cardinals prospect outfielder Oscar Tavares was killed in a car crash on Sunday. He was on his way driving to Puerto Plata in Dominican Republic. His girlfriend was also in the car, Adelia Arvelo. She was also killed with him in the car. Oscar Tavares, 22 years old, hit 429 in the NLCS with a home run. And if you look at Tavares' minor league stats, he was a career 320 in the minors. He started when he was 17 in 2009 for the ball club. Came all the way up. It was 2014, 22 years old. Gets the call up from the minors in his first ever season in the majors and was able to go all the way to the NLCS. Hit a home run. He lived the dream that any kid would dream of, and that's to be able to try to deliver big for your team in the playoffs. Sadly, it came to an abrupt end for the St. Louis Cardinals, and then now you get the news of this happening, and the details are pouring in as this podcast is going on, and the family has confirmed that it has happened, and his agent confirmed it as well. It came in, Ken Rosenthal did a report during the World Series broadcast on Sunday. And I'm looking at some of the photos from the actual crash that happened. It was a Chevy Camaro that he was driving. This thing is just absolutely folded up like an accordion. So Oscar Tavares, dead at the age of 22, promising prospect for the St. Louis Cardinals. May he rest in peace. And my condolences go out to his family as well as the family of Adelia Arvelo.
429 in the National League postseason for young Oscar Tavares. And that was his only season. It just makes you think, what if? What if this kid lived out the rest of his dream as a major league ball player? And it just kind of makes you think to, you know, hug your loved ones and cherish what you have, the team you root for, the players you root for. Cherish the life you have because it can just be gone tomorrow. And it's unfortunate for the Tavares family. It's unfortunate for Arvelo's family. And it's unfortunate for the St. Louis Cardinals organization and their teammates as well, that they are going through these losses right now.
That it is. So much potential gone, and it's a sad thing to see when somebody actually lives a dream that millions dream of and only a select few get
hit a home run, too. Hit a home run in that series as well.
That it is. So let's end this podcast on a positive note, since most of it was pretty negative.
Yeah, and a little bit of a downer as well, but hopefully next week we'll be talking about some Orioles Gold Glove Award winners. We'll be talking about the Ravens beating the Steelers or tying.
Tying as you want them to happen.
Oh, I just want them to tie to
the Would that be a positive? How do you feel about a tie?
I have no idea. Maybe Ray will finally give my blog some love.
Yeah, maybe.
Probably not.
Maybe I will. I was close this week, right?
You were close this week, yeah.
Yeah, it's a recurring joke on this podcast that I always get the name of his blog wrong.
But one name you should bookmark online, of course, is the Baltimore Sports Free-for-All.
On sfmsports.net, and this has been another edition of the Baltimore Sports Said Free-for-All. I'm Ray Atkinson.
I'm Josh Hall.
We will see you all